Had a chance to say hello to you.
Could you tell the Senate?
There you go.
Good evening, everyone. We're going to get started. I'm going to go ahead and call to order the committee, Joint Committee on Public Safety. Welcome, everyone. This is our first of our meetings, and being our first meeting, the first thing we need to do is take care of organization. And so the first thing I'll do is open up a work session for the purpose of adoption of the committee rules. Mr. Nasby.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, we have I've distributed the rules to you. I don't think there's anything terribly exciting in here. These are fairly standard for joint committees of this nature. If anyone has any questions, I would be happy to answer them.
It's my understanding these are the rules that have been used in other joint committees, and there's been no special provisions provided in these rules?
That's my understanding as well, Senator.
All right. So our co-chair will take a motion.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we accept the Joint Committee on Public Safety Committee rules that are dated 2/13/2013, right there.
Oh, good.
For this committee.
All right, thank you. Representative Olson has made a motion to adopt the Joint Committee Rules for Public Safety, dated 2/13, right here, 13.
Got it.
Is any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And now we have rules that we are now going to be working under. The next thing we'd like to do is have an introduction of committee members. And so what I would like to do is start from my left.
All right.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Wally Hicks, Josephine County.
And I'm Senator Roblin, District 5, which goes from Coos Bay to Tillamook Bay and into Sheridan.
Representative Krieger, District 1, South Coast.
Chris Garrett, District 38, Lake Oswego, Southwest Portland.
Andy Olson, Albany.
Senator Winters, District 10, Southwest Salem, Almsville, Turner, Monmouth, and Independence.
And Representative Jeff Barker from Beaverton, Illinois.
Senator Betsy Close, Albany Corvallis.
And Representative Greg Matthews, House District 50, primarily Gresham.
And I'm Floyd Przanski, State Senator representing District 4, which includes parts of Lane and Douglas counties. We again want to thank everyone that's here tonight. This is our first of our meeting. We have meeting schedule block dates on Wednesdays starting at 5:30. It looks like, knowing that some of our members do have committee assignments that will require them to be in committees prior to this up to maybe 5 o'clock. So give everyone an opportunity for transition. And then our second block time is on Fridays at 1 p.m. as a start time. Tonight we're going to have an overview. This is invited testimony from on the presentation of the Commission of the Public Safety Report from the Governor. And we're going to have three individuals that will be testifying and giving their perspective. Steve Powers from the Governor's Office, Paul Dominguez, former Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, who was the chair of the commission, and then also members of the Pew Charitable Trust as to their work in putting the presentation. I also will go ahead and put on the record for Friday, we will have our meeting starting at 1 p.m. It also is an informational meeting and invited testimony. We will have an alternative plan presented by ODAA, Colette Peters, and speaking from her perspective from corrections, forecast, et cetera. And I believe we're going to have community perspective from a couple of the community providers that will also be here. The reason we're doing informational meetings at this point is because at this point this committee does not have any bills assigned to it, at least this last check. And so this is going to give us an opportunity. We also have only four of the 10 members that are here tonight of the joint committee have actually been on the ground working this issue for basically the last 8+ months. We think it's important for those members who are new to this process to get a little familiarization as to what the Governor's Commission attempted to tackle and the perspectives that we have taken. And so the first couple of three meetings will be, in fact, informational only, and then we'll decide from there where what our next steps will be. So with that, Steve, why don't you come forward for the Governor's office?
Thank you, Co-Chair. For the record, Stephen Powers, Deputy General Counsel and Public Safety Advisor to Governor Kitzhaber.
co-chairs and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. When the governor issued Executive Order 12-08 in May 2012, reconvening the Commission on Public Safety, he noted in the order that the commitment by leaders of all three branches of government to address the unsustainable path we are traveling. It was important to him that we take stock of our current public safety system with its successes and challenges to chart a sustainable path for the future. At the same time, the governor, Chief Justice Ballmer, President Courtney, and co-speakers Hannah and Roebland sent a letter to the Public Safety Performance Project of the Pew Center on the States, expressing interest in participating in the Justice Reinvestment Initiative of the Bureau of Justice Assistance, or BJA, which is part of the U.S. Department of Justice. Oregon was selected, and you will be hearing after my testimony from former Chief Justice Paul DeMunez and Zoe Towns of Pew on the details of the commission. For my brief time before the Joint Committee, I just wanted to encapsulate the governor's reasoning for creating the commission. In his view, the demand for public services is increasing because of an aging population and because of the current economic climate. More people receiving nutritional assistance, more people on the Oregon Health Plan, while our public resources are shrinking. And the public resources we do have are increasingly being spent on health care and the human consequences of neglect and abuse, while our investment in education, educating our children and building a better economy is decreasing. And he noted that this trend is accelerating. This is at the same time that crime rates have decreased across the United States and here in Oregon. Both violent crime rates and property crime rates are at historic lows. The governor created the commission so we could look at what got us here and how we can build on a system that holds offenders accountable, implements evidence-based practices, and wisely invests our public safety dollars. We have public safety achievements that we should be proud of. Extensive use of probation in lieu of incarceration, an incarceration rate below the national average, and a prison system largely focused on violent and sexual offenders. But we all know that past performance does not indicate future results. We don't just pat ourselves on the back and stay the course without adjusting to the realities of the day. The governor believed and still believes there is room for improvement, and the cost of doing nothing is immense. Oregon is on track to add additional 2,300 beds over the next 10 years, much of that growth for nonviolent offenders. This will cost an additional $600 million over the next 10 years, which may not yield the best rate of return. Informing the commission, the governor asked, what is the best way to invest our public safety dollars to keep our community safe and reduce victimization? To be clear, this is not about dismantling the current system. Rather, this is about rebalancing the system. It's about preserving prison beds for violent and sexual offenders, while at the same time investing in community-based solutions to keep our community safe. As the commission discussed policy options, the governor stressed, we need to resist the temptation to hold on to 20th century practices and the false belief that building prisons alone will keep us safe. We cannot build our way to safe communities. We must use 21st century research and data as we enact policies to hold offenders accountable and invest in areas that provide safer communities. The governor saw an opportunity to embed evidence-based practices in our public safety system. He uses the analogy that it would be considered medical malpractice to ignore the advances that have been made in the medical and health fields in the last 30 years. To continue that analogy, in creating the commission, he posed the question, do we need to spend money on emergency room beds, or should our focus be on investing in practices that can make our communities healthier? The commission produced an outstanding report that Chief Justice DeMunez will take you through, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. Any questions for Steve? Steve, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So at this point, I was neglectful. I need to do one thing, that is introduce our staff person committee administrator is Josh Nasby. He will be the point person for the committee, so individuals who want to have correspondence with us that it is, if it's not directly with a member, to facilitate making sure all the members get the correspondence and information, please go through Josh. So with that, former Chief Justice Paul Domenis, also should recognize him as a distinguished jurist in residence at Willamette University. For someone that supposedly retired, it seems like you're staying continuously busy.
No rest for the wicked. Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Paul Domenis, currently senior judge in Oregon and professor at Willamette University College of Law. I want to just start my remarks first by just making reference to what a privilege it was to serve on the Governor's Commission with the members of the legislature. It was a high honor for me to work with all of you who served on that committee. It was really a process that I treasure, and I thank you for all your hard work. I will try to give you just a brief overview, and then I'll be joined here by Zoe Towns from the Pew Center. Let me just put this in some perspective. This is still a stark fiscal climate. We've distinguished ourselves by prioritizing data-driven policy making, focused on smart investments in long-term in the long-term needs of our state. As you all know, in the past two legislative sessions, our state leaders have shepherded comprehensive bipartisan legislation to reform our highest spending areas, education and health care. We've done so to ensure taxpayers are getting the best return on their investment in these core functions of government. As Mr. Power said, it's now time to turn our collective attention to the another core function, and that's the state's third highest category of spending, public safety. While Oregon's been considered a national trendsetter in sentencing and corrections policy, it's clear from our commission's work that recent trends threaten our leadership position and our ability to deliver the best possible public safety results. In the past decade, Oregon's prison population has grown nearly 50% to over 14,000 inmates, and taxpayers now spend more than $1.3 billion each biennium to pay for corrections. Meanwhile, Oregon has cut funding to critical public safety areas like state police, county sheriffs, community corrections, and victim services. Without actions, our prisons will consume an even greater share of Oregon's public safety budget and overall state spending. Currently, the state projects its prison population will grow by another 2,300 beds in the next 10 years. This prison growth, which the commission found would be fueled mostly by nonviolent offenders, will cost taxpayers an additional $600 million. Our state has convened several work groups to analyze the sentencing and corrections policies that drive our rising correctional population and costs, including the 2011 Commission on Public Safety that I also chaired. That prior work established an important foundation for the work that the 2012 Commission undertook. What the Commission found in Oregon's data was as expected. We are a state with tremendous public safety achievements. Commissioners were in complete accord that we began our process by taking stock of the many things that we have done well in our past in the public safety system. Paramount among these is the historic and sustained crime decline that we've experienced in Oregon. What's more, we've achieved this crime decline with comparably modest incarceration rate, one that is still below the national average, and a prison system that focuses largely on offenders convicted of violent crime and sex offenses. This means that for the most part, our state is appropriately focusing its most expensive public safety resource on the offenders who need it most. Finally, through its renowned commitment to evidence-based practices, Oregon's correctional system has achieved one of the lowest recidivism rates in the country. However, the Commission found that we've lost ground on some of these achievements over the past 10 years. Even though our state imprisonment rate hovers below the national average, it's grown at over three times the rate of the national average in the last 10 years. During that same period, Oregon's prisons admissions have grown to include increasing percentages of nonviolent offenders, which dilutes our state's strategy of concentrating prison beds on violent and sex offenders who warrant them most. Oregon also has been handing down longer sentences for all offense types, including nonviolent offenses, despite a growing body of research that points to the diminishing public safety returns of longer prison sentences. Oregon offenders are staying longer in prison today than they have in any point in the last decade. Finally, the commission found that the state directs increasing resources to prisons, that as it directs increasing resources to prison, resources for Oregon's community correction programs, lauded across the country for their success in reducing recidivism, have shrunk. Many counties face significant shortfalls in sanctions and services that they need in order to hold offenders accountable at the local level. Additionally, critical public safety agents like sheriffs, victim services provider, and the state police have gone underfunded. These shortfalls pose a real and pressing threat to sustaining Oregon's reductions in recidivism and victimization. So the report that you all are privy to now provides analysis and policy options that are intended to reduce the projected corrections growth, hold offenders accountable, and increase public safety. What became clear to us on the commission was that in order to improve public safety across the state, increased resources for local corrections and public safety are necessary. However, due to the projected prison population growth, continuing the status quo would make these additional resources impossible and would likely result in further cuts to local budgets. The Commission therefore focused on policy options designed to eliminate the 2,300-person growth over the next 10 years and reinvest a portion of the state's funding that would have been spent on corrections, in local corrections and in public safety services. Let me pause here and just tell you what our recommendations and policy options that you'll study will not do. They will not make any changes whatsoever to 19 of the 22 Measure 11 offenses. Our policy option packages will not decriminalize or legalize the possession, sale, or trafficking of any controlled substance. The policy options presented will not reduce the sentence of any inmate, will not reduce the sentence of any inmate currently under the jurisdiction of the Department of Corrections, and those policy options will not require resentencing of any offender. I think it's very important that when you start considering those policy options that you know what they will not do. Now, I wanted to start, those of you who know me well, I'll probably mess up this PowerPoint, but I do have a couple of slides that I want to use that I think will set the context for the rest of the data presentation. So slide one is I asked to be included here because it reflects the principles and the key findings that we found with regard to the 2011 commission. Okay, so those include when we do sentencing and corrections reform, we said you need to think about Oregon's constitution, justice reinvestment, cost-benefit analysis. We wanted increased judicial discretion, informed decision-making in sentencing, juvenile justice, crime victim services, offender reentry, and it was imperative that we listen to and interact with Oregon's voters. We'll see if this works. So as Mr. Powers indicated, in May of this year, there was a request from legislative leadership, the governor, and my successor, Chief Justice Ballmer, that the commission be reconvened and expanded And that commission was bipartisan, it was interbranch, and it was charged with analyzing Oregon's sentencing and corrections data, auditing existing policies, and submitting recommendations that will protect public safety while containing corrections costs and holding offenders accountable. As my colleagues who worked on the commission know, and for those new members of this committee, we were assisted in this massive effort to understand the data by the Pew Center. And I think it's important to know that Pew worked on this with us for two reasons. One, as Mr. Powers indicated, they were asked by all three branches of government to assist us. But there was a second reason they came. They came because they had done polling and survey work with the public and had determined that the public was vitally interested in the kind of sentencing and correction reform that had occurred in other states, so-called being smart on crime, and that the public was ready and willing to listen to this kind of reform. That's why Pew came to assist us. So quickly, I don't need to tell the members of the committee who they were who served on it, but for our new members, I think it's important that you see that we were assisted by, on our commission, by Colette Peters at Department of Corrections, by Director Scott Taylor from Community Corrections, by my own and Senator Winter's Sheriff Jason Myers, District Attorney John Foote from Clackamas County, John Collins, who I would like to single out, John Collins, Judge Collins from Yamhill County is one of the most senior and seasoned judges in Oregon. He was a longtime district attorney in Yamhill County. He has worked extensively on his own at understanding corrections practices and brought a great deal of experience to our commission. Larry Matazar, very experienced criminal defense lawyer for many years, and Dick Withnell, a very active business leader and community leader that we're privileged to say resides in Salem and Marion County, was a member of both commissions. Okay, I'm now at slide four. I thought it was important that you see how we undertook our work. So I'll just very briefly refer you to that slide, and you can see what our work plan was. So phase one was data and system analysis. So meeting two, analysis of prison spending drivers. Meeting three, analysis of prison spending drivers. Meeting four, we had system analysis, community corrections and institutions, and then we worked on key findings. Phase two was policy analysis, policies to address the drivers of prison population and prison population growth. I think it's very important that I pause here and tell all of you, I've been around these kinds of undertakings before. This was the most intense data-driven process that I have ever been involved in. And members of the legislature, you should also be proud of the policies that you have enacted in the past that have the data available for this kind of an undertaking. When we were able to measure, and these, I know that these will all be political things that have to be worked out, but when we went about this, when we looked at what is the impact if you change this policy, we didn't have to guess. Because the Oregon data is so good, you know what will be the impact if you do this. And so I commend you and those who have put together that data. In addition to our policy analysis, then we divided up into two groups. One was a corrections policy group, one was a sentencing policy group. We formulated those policies and then worked together to craft our report. Let me go to slide five because I think this is important. In addition to the work that we did in our commission, We also commissioned two victim roundtables hosted by the Attorney General. They included 35 victims, survivors, and advocates. They were held in Klamath Falls and Salem. They were facilitated by Ann Seymour, who is a national crime victim advocate, and attended by the Oregon Department of Corrections Director and, and Commission Member Colette Peters. The roundtable report was submitted to the Commission on Public Safety. So we'll now get to six, and I will start to ask Zoe to come up, because I think it's about time for us to start moving here with this. So Zoe has joined me here from Pew. You'll see here some of the initial data questions that we approached. She'll provide you with an abridged presentation. There is a lot more. This will be an abridged presentation today, and I encourage you to review our extensive data and research presentations that are available on our website. Let me also encourage our new members of this committee. Everything we did in public. All of it was recorded. All of the discussions that occurred among the commission, the testimony, all of it has been archived online and is all accessible to all of you. With that, I'm going to turn this over to Zoe Townsend. You'll have to introduce yourself, of course, for the record, but it's my pleasure to welcome her to the podium.
Right. So let's do this. If you'll have the microphone on the right to you, and Zoe, if you can use that other one. And they are very sensitive, so they don't need to be very close.
For the record, Zoe Towns from the Pew Charitable Trusts. Thank you for having me here this evening, committee members. I've met many of you and worked with some of you on the Commission on Public Safety. I will just back up briefly here. I'm going to talk a little bit about the data findings from the Commission on Public Safety and walk through some of the details that you just heard the Chief Justice summarize. But first, I want to just back up and tell you a little bit about the Pew Charitable Trusts and the work that we do around public safety. The Public Safety Performance Project is a program of the Pew Charitable Trust that's interested in helping state governments to advance fiscally sound, data-driven, evidence-based programs in public safety that get an improved return on taxpayer investment. We have worked over the course of the last 6 years in over a dozen states at the invitation of state leadership, Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Kentucky, Arkansas, Missouri, most recently in Georgia and South Dakota. I'm happy to talk through some of those state stories at a other time if there's interest. In every state, the general process that we undergo is to work with states that pull together a high-level task force, interbranch bipartisan task force, that's interested in analyzing the state corrections and sentencing system, looking at who's coming into prison, how long are they staying, what is it costing, what's happening in community corrections, what is that costing, what are the outcomes, and also to do a review of the research and best practices around community corrections and prisons to make sure that the state is employing that best practice and really getting the best return on their taxpayer investment in public safety. Both Mr. Powers and the Chief Justice alluded to justice reinvestment. We are in partnership with the Department of Justice on this initiative. As you can see here, the sort of general framework is if you're able to focus your prison beds on the most serious and violent offenders, you can contain the prison population, free up resources to reinvest into community corrections and local public safety. That will in turn improve public safety and lead to fewer crimes, fewer revocations, and ultimately continue to contain the prison population. It's an enforcing cycle. So to Oregon. As you have heard, we underwent a pretty extensive review of the data with the commission and with various Oregon state agencies. Just a few of them are listed here. We pulled crime data from the Uniform Crime Reports from the FBI, felony convictions data, admissions data, inmate-level data from the Oregon Department of Corrections, information from the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, from the Oregon Youth Authority, and information from the Oregon Office of Economic Analysis on your state forecast. What I'm going to do here is just really give you the highlights of some of the data that the commission saw. The commissioners and your peers will tell you a sort of underwent about 16 hours of and hundreds of slides of data on the sentencing correction system. This is just a small handful of those. It's an abridged version. I'm happy to answer any questions. I may have consolidated a little bit too much, so do stop me if you have questions, and we can dig in a little deeper. So what becomes immediately apparent in looking at Oregon's public safety data are the tremendous public safety achievements. As you've heard from several people tonight, Oregon really has been a paragon when it comes to public safety for states across the nation. We've worked in, as I said, many states, and we often use Oregon and Oregon's practices as an example for other states. So I'll just walk through some of the big achievements here. Oregon's experienced, like many states, a historic crime decline. The incarceration rate is below the national average, as you've heard. The prison system is largely focused on serious violent offenders. You have achieved significant reductions in your recidivism rate, and there's been early and broad support for evidence-based practices in Oregon. This is your crime decline in the last 10 years. Your crime rates have been declining for the last 20, but in the last 10 alone, you've experienced a 25% reduction in both in property and crime, sorry, property and violent crime rates. At the same time, your prison population has been on the rise, growing dramatically over the course of the last three decades. It's more than doubled since 1990, and it's grown nearly 50%, or by about 4,500 beds since 2000, which is, and that's the period we really focused on. We looked at the last 10 decades and the next 10 years, to give you a sense of what the current trends are. So you'll hear me talk about 2000 a lot and 2011, which is the year of the most current data. So one of the questions you might ask when you see a dramatically rising prison population is, well, is it because Oregon's been growing? The resident population, you know, will account for some of the growth in a prison population, perhaps. In the case of Oregon, the Oregon's prison population grew four times faster in the last decade than the resident population. 11% rise in the general population in Oregon, and a 47% rise, as we said, in the Oregon prison population. It's reflected also in the fact that Oregon's imprisonment rate has been on moving at a dramatic clip here. As the Chief Justice said, you do have an incarceration rate that's significantly below the national average incarceration rate. However, as the national average incarceration rate has kind of leveled off in the last 5 years, you've got Oregon catching up here, growing more than three times faster than the national incarceration rate since 2000. So when we began to dig into what was really causing this growth in the prison population, there's two factors in prison growth, and it really breaks down to admissions and or who you're letting into prison, who's being sent to prison, and how many, and length of stay, how long offenders are staying in prison. So I'll walk through both of those, some details on both of those factors. First, admissions. As you heard, Oregon, like most of the nation, sentences most of its felony offenders to probation rather than prison. However, in the last 10 years, the practice of sentencing offenders to prison instead of probation has actually grown by 18%. You also have nearly half of your prison admissions, your prison intakes in 2011 were offenders who were previously on supervision. So these are offenders who are on probation or on post-prison supervision who either committed a new crime or committed or violated the conditions of their probation or post-prison supervision and were revoked back to prison. You can see the 2000 population and the 2011 population. There's been a growth in technical revocations by 27% since 2000. And I'll just stop there to provide a little bit of clarity. Technical revocations is a term that's used, kind of an industry term, and it's used also by the Department of Corrections to capture that offender population that is on probation or post-prison supervision and has not committed a new crime that would send them to prison had they not been on supervision. So these are people who either committed a new crime that was a misdemeanor or and would have sent them to jail, or they just violated the terms of their supervision, and that could be anything from contacting a victim to a dirty drug test. Those are technical revocators. So this population has grown as a percentage of admissions by 27% in the last decade. Other admissions trends, as you've heard, Oregon has been focusing the majority of its prison beds on serious and violent offenders, sex offenders. In the last decade, prison admissions for sex and person offenders, Oregon's category for violent offenders, have more or less stayed the same, declining slightly, where the population coming in for property and other offenders, and other as a category for nonviolent offenses that are not drug or property, has actually grown pretty substantially. So you've got property offenders coming in at 8% more often as a share of admissions, and other nonviolent offenders growing as a share of admissions by 42%. We also looked at some of the data and information on risk levels in the offender population, and I'll just stop here and provide some more clarity. I know that there has been a lot of discussion about risk to recidivate and what that means in both in the media and here, I'm sure. And so I'll pause for a moment to provide some background here. Oregon has a risk assessment tool which is able to measure offenders' risk to recidivate. And what that means is, for those offenders leaving prison, how likely someone is to reoffend a felony in the next 3 years. The tool is housed at the Criminal Justice Commission and is used on the offender level data from the Oregon Department of Corrections. And so it's used right now to help determine supervision levels and to help determine need levels. We used it to try and look at what was happening in the risk to recidivate levels in your offender population coming into prison. In the last 10 years, across all offense types, the low and medium risk offense categories have actually gone up. You can see it in the person admissions, and you can see it also in the nonviolent admissions. Now, whether someone is a low risk to recidivate does not mean that they did not commit a tremendously awful crime. You can see with these person admissions, you can have murderers who are low risk to recidivate. What was interesting is that these low risk offenders were actually coming in at a greater rate, especially in the drug admissions and in the property admissions. So just to review here quickly for some of the admissions key findings, since 2000, Oregon's prison population has grown by nearly 50% to more than 14,000 inmates. Oregon's incarceration rate remains below the national average but has grown three times as fast as the national average in the last decade. And while the majority of Oregon's prison space continues to be focused on violent and sex offenders, the prison population net has widened to include an increasing number of nonviolent offenders, including technical violators. So I talked about admissions and also length of stay as a factor that drives prison growth. In general, length of stay is on the rise in Oregon. This is just the average length of stay, regardless of offense type. It has been going up in the last 10 years. Offenders are spending more time behind bars than they have been in the last decade today. This is true across all offense types. It's true for both person crimes, it's true for sex crimes, and it's also true for your nonviolent crimes. This is just we pulled out the property and drug crimes. Drug offenders are spending 22% longer in prison in 2011 than they were in 2000. Property offenders are spending 7% longer in 2011 than they were in 2000. So those technical violators I talked to you about earlier on are also coming to prison for longer periods of time in the last 10 years. You got a 20% rise in length of stay for technical violators of probation since 2000. So just to quickly recap here, you have offenders spending more time in prison in 2011 than at any other point in the last decade, and this is true across all offense types. So we talked a little bit earlier, and you heard from the Chief Justice about how the Commission did an analysis of community corrections and evidence-based practices to see sort of what's working, what could be improved. What we really tried to do was walk the Commission through some of the latest research and evidence-based practices and to talk to community corrections departments and sheriffs and other practitioners to find out what's happening, where are there gaps in evidence-based practices, and can they be filled. So some of the underlying principles here that are being employed and best practices across the country are focusing on high-risk offenders, so focusing your resources on the highest-risk offenders and targeting their criminogenic needs. This means you need risk assessment tools, you need needs assessment tools. Also front-loading resources. When offenders leave prison, they're at their most susceptible to recidivate, so it's important to do that reentry work, to do that work right when they're coming out of prison to make sure that you're capturing the highest, the most vulnerable point there. The administration of swift, certain, and proportional sanctions for violations of supervision, incorporating rewards and incentives, and incorporating surveillance with treatment. So it's not enough to just give drug treatment. You have to also be doing day reporting centers, check-ins, electronic monitoring. So we sort of did a report card with the commission after the system assessment of evidence-based practices in Oregon. And I think the first thing that was really important to note, and this has been noted before, is that Oregon is well ahead of the curve when it comes to evidence-based practices. You started to employ these early and much sooner than most of the states across the nation. So for the last 20 years, you've been using graduated sanctions, which are swift, certain, proportional sanctions, and you actually have SB 267 in statute, which requires that funds for community corrections and other programs be evidence-based and cost-effective. So there's definitely some real achievements there. There were also some gaps and some opportunities to build upon Oregon's use of evidence-based practices. There was gaps in the use of risk and needs assessment, especially in probation conditions. There was gaps in earned compliance credits. So there is earned time, as many of you know, for offenders in prison, but there was no earned compliance credits for offenders on community supervision. And there were gaps in the structured sanctions statutory requirements. So while some probationers are receiving structured sanctions, some were being waived out of them, and so we're having to return straight to court and possibly prison after their first violation. However, the most pressing threat to evidence-based practices and the continuation of reducing recidivism in Oregon was really the shortfall of local sanctions and services. So the drug treatment, the mental health treatment, these programs that are essential to evidence-based practices, also the sanctions, so the jail beds, the day reporting centers, electronic monitoring, there's been a real shortage of them. We talked to many community corrections officers and department heads that were vocal about the fact that their capacity to continue to reduce recidivism and implement evidence-based practices was really under threat. Just to give you a quick sense of that, the availability of sanctions varies widely by county, and this doesn't actually capture the capacity in each county, but it does capture just the programs that are available. So you see Marion County there has a handful of possible sanctions, but if you're in Josephine, you have much less. If you're in Harney, less, Clackamas, et cetera. So it really depends county to county the kind of services offenders can receive. So two for treatment options, wide variance across counties in terms of the kind of practices that can be employed. I'll just very quickly, and this is, you know, information I'm sure you all have already, but just talk very briefly about the budget for DOC. As you all know, it's around $1.3 billion a biennium, and the bulk of that money is a state expenditure, very small slice, federally funded, but the bulk of it is really paid for by state taxpayers. In the last 10 years, this DOC budget has grown as a percentage of the general and lottery fund spending by 23%. It's also grown as a share of the state's public safety spending by about 8%. So you see the DOC budget here taking up already a little under half and then now over half of the state's total public safety spending. Very briefly, and I think you'll probably hear a lot more about this on Friday from the DOC director, but this was sort of the one of the main impetuses for the commission's work, and that's the projections for the prison population over the course of the next 10 years. The population is expected to grow, and this is analysis done by the Oregon Office of Economic Analysis, by roughly 2,300 beds by 2023. So I'm almost wrapping up here, but I just wanted to leave you with a little bit of the research that we walked the commission through, and this is some of the research on incarceration and crime, crime reduction. I think that one of the first questions people ask when they consider the two greatest trends in sentencing and corrections in America, so the two trends being, one, the massive decline in crime rates over the course of the last 20 years, and the second being the enormous rise in the use of incarceration. So the kind of question immediately as well is does one account for the other? Have prisons solved the crime problem? And there's been a great deal of research on this from criminologists, economists, all sorts, and the consensus, research consensus indicates that increased incarceration did contribute measurably to the decreased crime since the 90s, although it did have a minority contribution. So certain experts will put it from 10% to 30% in terms of what the credit it can take for the decrease in crime rates in America. Other factors, the waning crack epidemic, the changes in urban planning, evidence-based policing, there's a great deal of a host of other factors that make up the difference. So prison has been essential. It's been an essential tool in the toolbox, but there are also a lot of other things that can take credit for the crime decline. The second point that I think is important is the growing and the new and growing body of research around the limitations for incarceration as a recidivism reduction tool. So I should say first that beyond the crime control benefit, many Oregonians and many Americans are going to support the use of prison and even long prison terms for serious violent offenders for justice purposes, of course. There is a growing body of research showing that for many low-level offenders, prison terms are more likely to increase than to decrease recidivism. And at the same time, for a substantial number of offenders, there's little or no evidence to show that keeping them locked up longer actually prevents additional crime. So this research has provoked serious questions about whether long prison terms are the most effective way to increase public safety. Just to give you a sense of some of this research, and we can definitely provide you with more. There were a lot of studies that we gave to the commission, but here's a quote from two criminologists. There would be little lost by having the average sentence length for easy-to-replace functionaries within the drug distribution system, lookouts, typical retail sellers, hired hands, et cetera. This is a quote about reducing length of stay for drug offenders. Finally, just to kind of give you a sense of this relationship between incarceration and the crime decline, if you look at the national picture here, you do see this very simple story, increasing incarceration rate, a plummeting crime rate. But when you begin to look at states and individual state experiences, it really tells a different story. You've got Maryland, New Jersey, and New York here that have in the last, about 15 years, been able to keep their incarceration rate down and also keep their crime rate down. 17 states in the last decade have reduced both their incarceration and their crime rate. And so these trends are sort of shifting, and research like what I referred to is really prompting states to ask the question, who should be sent to prison? How long should they be there? Are they getting the best return on these expensive prison beds? I'll end there and happy to take any questions at all. Thank you.
All right, colleagues, this is a lot of information to take in a very short period of time, but we do have time for questions at this point if people would like to zero in on any of the information. Also, if it's something that you want to absorb, I'm not sure, Ms. Towns, what your schedule, will you be here?
I can be available at any point to answer questions on this. I'd be happy to.
Are you scheduled to be here through Friday?
Yes.
All right, so that's another way for members to get information if you want to go a little better in detail with the questions and stuff. I know that she'll make herself available for that. Other questions or comments?
Well, Mr. Chair, you might also introduce Lynn, too, because he's part of a few, too.
Lynn, why don't you come on up? And Lynn Engel is also has been part of the process, and I think that's fair. Just for the record, if you'll put your name.
For the record, my name is Lynn Engel. I work for the Crime and Justice Institute and a member of the Pew team. Thank you for the opportunity.
All right. So these two individuals who have been, say, more or less the point people, Gabrielle has also worked with us. I'm not sure if she's going to be coming back or not, but that's a third person. Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's more a comment, although you're welcome to respond to it. I think just as we leave here tonight after our first meeting, one thing that we really have to keep in mind, because it might have gotten lost in that presentation, but this committee needs to keep its eye on it as we go forward, is that this commission did not start from the false premise that we have a broken system that we have to rebuild. We, as you saw, the first thing we had to absorb is that our system actually is succeeding in many ways, but a lot of the elements of the system that have made it a success are being eroded because of a skewed misdirection of resources away from some of those investments that have made us successful. And so that's why the Commission's report, in my opinion, is really, I think it'd be more accurate to call it a pretty modest course correction than any kind of a fundamental change in strategy for the state. Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Excuse me, Senator Roblin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say, as one of those people that sent a letter after a request from some of the other people on this dais, I want to thank the Chief Justice for taking on being the chairperson of this adventure, and to Pew for doing exactly what was just stated, and that is looking at what was working and looking at the continued trends, because I think it's easy for us sometimes to see trends and pat ourselves on the back and forget that there's new trends starting. And I think what we have as a group to look forward to now is to look at all this data and all the information and the fact that it's been accumulated in a way that makes it easier for us as a committee to look at and see, are there things that we can learn from new trends that were developed from the information, and continue to use the time-honored Oregonian belief that best practices and learning from our past to preferred our future can hopefully help us continue to gain better public safety at home and at a cost that everybody can understand, and that the reinvestment back into the communities can enhance Oregonians' belief in their system and help people who made bad choices make better choices and be a part of our society. And that's my hope from this commission. And I want to thank you for all the work, because I know this is just a short portion of the stuff that and the information you looked at. I look forward to seeing more, and I look forward to the conversations that are going to happen here.
All right, thank you. Any other comments? Well, colleagues, thank you very much for taking the information. For the four co-chairs, we appreciate you being part of the team as we work forward on these important issues. And I will offer myself and all the co-chairs to assist members to help get up to speed. We know that you're coming in handicapped, not having the months of time in the 10 meetings that we participated in around the state. But we're thank you for your time tonight and our continuation of this work. And we're adjourned until Friday at 1 p.m.